I spent September getting ready for Oxford, saying goodbye to friends and watching the presidential campaign unfold. I was eligible for the draft, so I checked in with the local board chairman, Bill Armstrong, about when I could expect to be called. Though graduate deferments had been abolished the previous spring, students were allowed to finish the term they were in. Oxford had 3 8-week terms a year, divided by 2 5-week vacation periods. I was told that I wouldn't be in the October call, and that I might be able to stay beyond one term, depending on how many people my local draft board had to supply. I wanted to go to Oxford badly, even if I got to stay only a couple of months. The Rhodes Trust would allow people to do their military service and come to Oxford afterward. But since I had decided to be in the draft with no end in sight in Vietnam, it didn't seem prudent to think about afterward. On October 4th, I went to Pier 86 on the Hudson River to board the SS United States for England. I knew where the huge ocean liner was headed, but I had no idea where I was going. The United States was then the fastest liner on the seas, but the trip still took nearly a week. It was a long-standing tradition for the Rhodes Group to sail together so that they could get acquainted. The ship's leisurely pace and group dining did give us time to get to know one another, to meet some other passengers, and to decompress a little out of the hothouse American political environment. Most of us were so earnest we almost felt guilty about enjoying the trip. We were surprised to meet people who were far less obsessed with Vietnam and domestic politics than we were. One day a man invited a few of us to his suite for cocktails. I'd never had a drink before and had never wanted one. I hated what liquor had done to Roger Clinton and was afraid it might have the same effect on me. But I decided the time had come to overcome my lifelong fear. When our host asked me what I wanted, I said, "Scotch and soda," a drink I had made for others when I worked as a bartender for a couple of private parties in Georgetown. I had no idea what it would taste like, and when I tried it, I didn't like it very much. On balance, I'm glad I broke free of my fear of tasting liquor on the ship, and I'm relieved I never had a craving for it. I've had enough problems without that one. After 5 days and a brief stop in Le Havre, we finally arrived at Southampton, where we caught our first glimpse of Oxford in the person of Sir Edgar Bill Williams, the warden of Rhodes House. He was waiting for us on the dock in a bowler hat, raincoat, and umbrella, looking more like an English dandy than like the man who, during World War II, had served as chief of intelligence to Field Marshal Montgomery. Bill Williams herded us onto a bus for the ride to Oxford. It was dark and rainy, so we didn't see much. When we got to Oxford, it was about 11 p.m., and the whole town was shut down tight as a drum, except for a little lighted truck selling hot dogs, bad coffee, and junk food on High Street, just outside University College, where I had been assigned. The bus let us off, and we walked through the door into the main quadrangle, built in the 17th century, where we were met by Douglas Millen, the head porter who controlled access to the college. Millen was a crusty old codger who took the college job after he retired from the Navy. He was very smart, a fact he took pains to hide behind torrents of good-natured verbal abuse. He especially liked to work the Americans over. The first words I heard from him were directed at Bob Reich, who was less than 5 feet tall. He said he'd been told he was getting 4 Yanks, but they'd sent him only 3 1/2. He never stopped making fun of us, but behind it, he was a wise man and a shrewd judge of people. I spent a lot of time over the next 2 years talking to Douglas. In between the bloody hells and various other English epithets, he taught me how the college really worked, told me stories of the main professors and staff, and discussed current affairs, including the differences between Vietnam and World War II. Over the next 25 years, whenever I got back to England, I dropped in to see Douglas for a reality check. At the end of 1978, after I had been elected governor of Arkansas the first time, I took Hillary to England for a much-needed vacation. When we got to Oxford, I was feeling pretty proud of myself as we walked through the front door of the college. Then I saw Douglas. He didn't miss a beat. "Clinton," he said, "I hear you've just been elected king of some place with 3 men and a dog." I love Douglas Millen. My rooms were in the back of the college, behind the library in Helen's Court, a quaint little space named after the wife of a previous master of the college. 2 buildings faced each other across a small, walled-in space. The older building on the left had 2 doors to 2 sets of student rooms on the ground floor and the second floor. I was assigned to the rooms on the left side of the second floor at the far entrance. I had a small bedroom and a small study that were really just one big room. The toilet was on the first floor, which often made for a cold walk down the stairs. The shower was on my floor. Sometimes it had warm water. The modern building on the right was for graduate students who had two-story flats. In October of 2001, I helped Chelsea unpack her things in the flat with a bedroom directly opposite the rooms I had occupied 33 years earlier. It was one of those priceless moments when the sunshine takes away all life's shadows. While beginning to learn about Oxford in England, I was also trying to follow election developments from afar and was eagerly awaiting the absentee ballot with which I would cast my first vote for president. On November 5th, Hubert Humphrey lost the election to Richard Nixon by 500,000 votes, 43.4% to 42.7%, to 13.5% for George Wallace, who ran as an independent. Nixon won 301 electoral votes, 31 over a majority, with close victories in Illinois and Ohio. Nevertheless, the deeply embedded nightmares of 1968 formed the arena in which I and all other progressive politicians had to struggle over our entire careers. Perhaps if Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy had lived, things would have been different. Perhaps not. Regardless, those of us who believed that the good in the 1960s outweighed the bad would fight on, still fired by the heroes and dreams of our youth. The uncertainty of my own life was reinforced when my friend Frank Aller, a Rhodes Scholar at Queens College, received his draft notice from his hometown Selective Service Board in Spokane, Washington. He told me he was going home to prepare his parents and girlfriend for his decision to refuse induction and to stay in England indefinitely to avoid going to jail. Frank was a China scholar who understood Vietnam well and thought our policy was both wrong and immoral. He was also a good middle-class boy who loved his country. He was miserable on the horns of his dilemma. Strobe Talbot, who lived just down the street in Magdalen College, and I tried to console and support him. Frank was a good-hearted man who knew we were as opposed to the war as he was, and he tried to console us in return. He was particularly forceful with me, telling me that unlike him, I had the desire and the ability to make a difference in politics, and it would be wrong to throw my opportunities away by resisting the draft. His generosity only made me feel more guilty. He was cutting me more slack than I could allow myself. After spending the Christmas holiday with Mother, Jeff Dwyer, who would soon be her husband, and Roger, I flew back to England. The next day, January 13th, I went to London for my draft exam. The doctor declared me, according to my fanciful diary notes, one of the healthiest specimens in the Western world, suitable for display at medical schools, exhibitions, zoos, carnivals, and base training camps. My struggles with the draft rekindled my long-standing doubts about whether I was or could become a really good person. Apparently, a lot of people who grow up in difficult circumstances subconsciously blame themselves and feel unworthy of a better fate. I think this problem arises from leading parallel lives, an external life that takes its natural course and an internal life where the secrets are hidden. When I was a child, my outside life was filled with friends and fun, learning and doing. My internal life was full of uncertainty, anger, and a dread of ever-looming violence. No one can live parallel lives with complete success. The two have to intersect. At Georgetown, as the threat of Daddy's violence dissipated, then disappeared, I had been more able to live one coherent life. Now the draft dilemma brought back my internal life with a vengeance. Beneath my new and exciting external life, the old demons of self-doubt and impending destruction reared their ugly heads again. I would continue to struggle to merge the parallel lives, to live with my mind, body, and spirit in the same place. In the meantime, I've tried to make my external life as good as possible and to survive the dangers and relieve the pain of my internal life. This probably explains my profound admiration for the personal courage of soldiers and others who put their lives at risk for honorable causes, and my visceral hatred of violence and abuse of power, my passion for public service, and my deep sympathy for the problems of other people. The solace I have found in human companionship, and the difficulty I've had in letting anyone into the deepest recesses of my internal life. It was dark down there. On April 30th, the war finally came directly home to me, with a strange twist that was a metaphor for those bizarre times. I received my draft notice. I was ordered to report for duty on April 21st.